Welcome once again to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. I'm your host, Jeff Hayden. Whether to protect federal property, quell free speech, or out-and-out sow unrest, federal agents have appeared in Portland and Seattle. Protesters in Portland report these agents ride in unmarked black vans, cover their faces with visored helmets, dress in battle fatigues, carry automatic weapons, and wear neither name tags nor insignia. They're suspected of being agents of the Border Patrol or Homeland Security, perhaps marshals, but no one knows for sure. They're abducting peaceful protesters from the streets without warrants or probable cause, and so far releasing them without charges. Journalists have been tear gassed. These mysterious agents are already in Portland, Seattle, and President Trump has threatened to send them to Chicago, Albuquerque, and other cities, including cities in the Bay Area. The president's been very clear about targeting cities that are led by Democrats. The state of Oregon filed a civil rights suit seeking to stop him, but has failed, at least for the moment. So tonight our topic is insurrection, what the president can and cannot do. And most importantly, where is all this leading? Is President Trump laying the groundwork for a campaign based on civil disorder and cuts to the police? For contesting the election and refusing to leave the White House if he in fact loses the election? As always, we're eager to hear what's on your mind, and there's much to discuss. Our phone number in the studio is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you're outside of San Francisco, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. Bear in mind that our attorney guest cannot provide you with legal advice without all of the facts relating to a given case. However, we're happy to pass along the legal principles to assist you in your decision-making. And please, when you give us a call, remember that these events, for myriad reasons, can be troubling to all of us, irrespective of our individual political persuasions. Let's try to keep the calls civil and not make them personal. Again, our phone number right here is 415-841-4134. If you're outside the local dialing area and you want us to pay the freight, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. To help us sort out this latest crisis of the Republic, we have with us Professor Lawrence Douglas, is the James Grossfeld Professor of Law, Jurisprudence, and Social Thought at Amherst College. He's the author of 7 books, most recently, Will He Go? Trump and the Looming Electoral Meltdown in 2020, in which he describes what could happen if Donald Trump refuses to accept a loss in the November election. Dean Johnson is a practicing attorney. He's also an Emmy-nominated legal and political analyst with commentator Dean has worked with news media ranging from NBC to Fox News, from ABC to Al Jazeera. He is the founder of Pundit Network, which he describes as a social media with a conscience. Welcome both of you to Your Legal Rights.
Hey, Jeff, nice to be here tonight.
Pleasure to be with you, Jeff Dean, and Dean.
Dean, let's start with you. Give us the legal context. What is, is what President Trump doing illegal or legal?
Well, let's put it this way. It may be legal. At least it's not clearly illegal. Just to give you a little bit of background, since the very beginning of the United States, Congress, the electorate, our entire government has resisted the idea of forming a national police force. And there's good reason for that. The reason is that the hallmark of authoritarianism is a national police force accountable only to the man at the top. And that seems to be what is appearing on our streets now. There are a couple of laws that regulate what the president can and cannot do with respect to enforcing our domestic laws, that is, having federal agents act as a police force. One is called the Posse Comitatus Act, and that's, now that's Latin, but if you remember those old westerns where the sheriff would go after the bad guys and he would go out and round up a posse to go chase the villains, well, that's a Posse Comitatus. It's recruiting people who don't normally enforce the law to help enforce the law. And what the Posse Comitatus Act says is that anybody, including the President of the United States, who attempts to use the military or the militia to enforce domestic laws, that is the laws of cities, counties, and states, is guilty of a crime. Now, with all laws, there are exceptions. And the exception that may or may not apply here is a thing called the Insurrection Act. And that lays out the circumstances under which the president can use the military to enforce domestic laws, and in essence, converting the military into police force. And there are three basic circumstances. One is where there is what's termed an insurrection against a state or local government, where the state or local government can't maintain law and order, and the government officials of a state invite the president to send in the militia or send in the military to help with law enforcement. The second is wherever there is an unlawful insurrection or rebellion, the president may call up the armed forces to suppress the rebellion if it's such that it interferes with the exercise of rights by other citizens. And the last part is the last exception is one that uses the word shall. And it says the president shall use the military to suppress any insurrection if the insurrection hinders the execution of state or federal law to the extent that constitutional rights are violated. And the background on that is essentially the Ku Klux Klan. After the Civil War, the Ku Klux Klan was organizations in states, essentially terrorist organizations that prevented people, freed African-American slaves from exercising their constitutional rights. And at one point, the military was used for that purpose. As soon as Southern senators and congressmen got back to Washington and the national government was functioning again, they introduced this Insurrection Act to keep that from happening, and provided that only in very limited circumstances could that happen. So that's the legal context. The question is the president within the bounds of this law? And I hate to use the term loophole, but it looks like the president has found a loophole. Both of these acts refer to the military or the militia. Militia is essentially the National Guard. He's not using the military or militia. He's using, apparently, federal agents who are charged with law enforcement, at least with the enforcement federal law, like Homeland Security, Border Patrol, Bureau of Prisons, U.S. Marshals, and so on. So he's not, strictly speaking, violating the Posse Comitatus Act. And similarly, he's not calling up a militia or the military to quell an insurrection. He hasn't really invoked the Insurrection Act. That requires a formal declaration on his part, asking the people who are conducting the insurrection to disperse and go back home. He hasn't done that because he doesn't need to, because he hasn't called up the military. So we're now at the point where there's a giant hole in the law that President Trump seems to have found to create what is, in effect, a national police force that is accountable, if anybody, only to him. And there doesn't seem to be a whole lot legally that anybody can do about it as yet. And the real question, as you pointed out, Jeff, is where does this lead? And why is this happening? And there are a lot of thoughts about why this is happening. And that's one of the reasons I'm so happy that Professor Douglas has joined us tonight, because this all may be part of a larger strategy. This may be Trump actually thinking strategically for once and anticipating what may happen around, say, November.
Dean, we also have on the line our first caller who I've spoken with before. I think that Starchild, who is on the line, may have some interesting thoughts on this idea himself. Let me welcome you to Your Legal Rights. And also, because we have a slight delay, you might want to make sure your radio is turned all the way down.
Yeah, thank you. Can you hear me, Chris?
Yes, we hear you fine.
Yeah.
Great. I actually wasn't going to weigh in on the whole Posse Comitatus Act and the possibility of Trump not losing office if he loses the election, although I think those are important and interesting topics to discuss. But I was wondering about a couple things related to election fairness. Most people probably among your listeners, I don't know actually how many people are aware, but many of your listeners may not be aware that there is a third candidate running who is a woman who's likely to be on the ballot in all 50 states, Jo Jorgensen. I haven't heard any coverage of her on NPR, but her website is jo20.com.
Do voters
have any right to fair and open debates, for example? No alternative candidates have been included since 1992 when Ross Perot was in debates and gave the two-party cartel, as I call it, a bad scare. The Commission on Presidential Debates is entirely controlled by the Democrats and Republicans, and they shut out alternative candidates. And a related question, do taxpayer-funded media outlets in particular, like NPR, for example, have any obligation to cover elections in a fair and neutral manner and to let listeners know to give equal coverage to candidates like Jo Jorgensen or the candidate of the Green Party, Howie Hawkins? It's left-leaning coverage in an already left-leaning area like San Francisco, unfortunately. I think that NPR is potentially contributing to the problem of polarization rather than providing balance. You know, make sense of public radio and TV in areas like Texas or Alabama or whatever, they're right-leaning, if they provided left-leaning coverage there, or at least neutral coverage, and in left-leaning areas provided, right-leaning coverage or at least neutral coverage, so that it was helping address the problem of polarization and people getting in their ideological echo chambers. But I find it very frustrating as an alternative party activist that there's so little coverage of alternative candidates. You know, it's like your one vote is not going to decide who gets elected anyway. So people's idea that, oh, if I vote for somebody who's not one of the cartel candidates, that I'm wasting my vote because that person can't win. Well, it's more like taking an opinion poll. If you vote for option B in an opinion poll just because you think everybody else is going to vote for option B, nobody takes opinion polls that way. But for some reason, when it comes to elections, I think because the media doesn't educate people about this, people think, oh, well, if I don't vote for one of the most popular choices, that I'm somehow throwing away my vote. So I've given you a lot of stuff to address there, but I'd appreciate your thoughts on any of this, either legal advice or just, what can be done to increase fairness in the media and in the official or semi-official things like the debates.
Before you hang up, I also want to point out a couple things. One is I'm trying to get together an election-related show closer to the election, not so much to talk about the candidates per se, but more about election law and how this is all structured. And I think that you might find that really interesting. I also think that if I can get that show together, we could use your input on that as well. But when you were speaking earlier, you gave the name of an alternative candidate and also her website, but it went by so fast that before I turn it over to my guests to take a crack at some of the things you brought up, it would be perhaps beneficial if you could repeat her name and say her website, or her email with a little slower take so that people can get it.
Sure. Sorry about that. I'm always in the expectation the hosts are going to cut me off at any second. So sometimes I'm just trying to get as much.
The only time I will ever cut you off ever is if the only time I ever cut anybody off is if they attack one of my guests personally, and I don't do that. So as long as it's kept civil, you know, I welcome your input. It's a different viewpoint than we usually get from callers, and I welcome it.
Well, yeah, I appreciate that, Chris. And her name is Jo, that's J-O, last name Jorgensen, J-O-R-G-E-N-S-E-N. Her running mate is Spike Cohen. They are, like I said, both expected to be on all 50 ballots, 50 state ballots representing the Libertarian Party. And the website is jo20.com. There's other websites also that people might want to be aware of, like freeandequal.org is a website that's pressing for open debates for precedent and alternative parties being included and so forth. There are numerous alternative parties in this country. The five, you know, or the three besides the Democrats and Republicans that are basically nationally organized are the Libertarian Party, probably leading one at this point, and the Green Party on the left, and then the Constitution Party on the right. The media, unfortunately, does such a poor job of covering people's alternatives and choices. They tend to just reinforce the candidates that people are already aware of and have already heard of and give people the false impression that they have to choose, you know, one of those candidates or one of those parties. If people understood that their vote is not changing the outcome, it's just reflecting their preference, and if people don't vote based on their conscience, if they vote instead based on how they expect other people to vote because of what the media has been telling them, the democracy is essentially broken because the outcomes will never reflect the true preferences of the electorate.
You've given us a bit to think about. I would turn it over to my guest. Do you have any comments on what Dr. Charles brought up?
Well, I just asked the caller to stick around because I think we're going to have a real interesting tutorial here on the nuts and bolts of the electoral process. So you may learn something. Thanks for calling.
And Professor, you have anything you want to throw in there on what he was bringing up?
There's not a whole lot that I want to say at this moment. Maybe it's one thing is, you know, maybe this is an obvious point, but it's worth bearing in mind that it's not simply a feature of our media environment, which makes it difficult for third party candidates or for candidates from smaller parties to get sufficient airtime. It's also a feature of our electoral system itself. I mean, in as much as we're kind of tethered to this electoral college, and the electoral college is kind of this first past the post system in which all the electoral votes are awarded to the winner of a popular vote within states, it really means that in order for you to capture any kind of electoral college votes, you really have to have majority win in states. And of course, it's very different than a parliamentary system, which makes it much more possible to have smaller parties find meaningful representation within the federal system of government.
And obviously, fundraising is a huge part of it, more so now than ever. And it's very hard for a third party to gather enough money to get the kind of exposure they need on in the national media, and the national media may be talking a lot more than they're selling ads, but the fact is it's all intertwined. And if what they say is not going to bring them more sponsors, then they may have a monetary incentive to focus more on those people that are bringing the money in.
For sure.
And if you want to stay on the line as we continue the discussion, you're welcome to.
Okay. I wasn't sure if people could hear me if I started responding to the last guest, but I don't think I'm on the air anymore at this point, am I? Or am I?
No, you're still with us. You're still with us.
Okay. Started to mention, I think some of the states, maybe just in primary elections, but are starting to reform their system so that instead of a winner-take-all approach to delegates from that state, that they are divided proportionally among the candidates according to what percentage of the vote they got in that state?
Yeah, actually, that's not entirely accurate. There are, of the 50 states, 48 of them work on a winner-take-all system. The two states that are exceptions are Nebraska and Maine. And I don't think you find a trend in that direction at all, because I think states recognize that in as much as they rely on a district approach rather than a statewide approach, what they end up doing is they end up kind of watering down their power to affect the national outcome. So it's unfortunately, it's not in their state's interest to adopt that system. The other thing I should mention is awarding electors based on the district-wide vote rather than the statewide vote. That might sound like a somewhat more democratic approach, and I think that's what the caller was suggesting. But it would only be a more democratic approach if district lines were drawn on coherent democratic principles. And we know for a fact that's not the case in the United States. We have this, you know, very severe problem of gerrymandering. And so to the extent that you move from a statewide to a district-wide winner-take-all model, what you end up doing is you simply end up making the gerrymandered districts play all the more powerful a role in the selection of the president.
Well, thanks for the clarification there, and those are certainly valid points. But I agree with you that the lack of having a parliamentary-type system of proportional representation or something like that is definitely part of what holds alternative parties back. But there's a lot of discriminatory rules as well. For example, I'm a candidate for state assembly here in San Francisco, District 17, and to get a statement on the ballot, it costs over $1,500 just to have voters be able to read something about what I stand for along with my name. And that kind of thing, and $5,000 to run for mayor in San Francisco just to file. And so these kind of things discriminate against poor people, people from alternative parties, you know, people who don't have a lot of corporate or big money backing to even be able to participate in the system. The Libertarian Party nationally spends a good chunk of its budget, I believe more than a third, just in ballot access, like fighting with the state governments to be able to get our candidates on the ballot. A lot of them have discriminatory and unfair rules where, like, alternative candidates and parties are required to collect more signatures than Democrats and Republicans are to get on the ballot, and things like this that are just, in some cases, very explicitly, you know, designed to shut out anybody who's not part of the cartel.
We do see a bill that circulates every so often in California about a proportional vote in the Electoral College, but it's only triggered first. It has not passed, to my knowledge, ever. And even on its own terms, were it to pass, it's only triggered when a specified number of other states has agreed to pull the plug. And that's so far out of reach that I just don't see it happening anytime soon.
But what about my point about NPR and other media, but especially the media like NPR that are getting funding from the taxpayers to try to provide more objective and neutral coverage or to try to counter the polarization by tailoring their you know, coverage that leans one way or the other to areas where that kind of coverage is needed or is absent? And I appreciate your taking the call, and this show sounds like you're making a good effort to include some non-traditional perspectives, but the media on the whole, I think, is really falling down on this. Do you have, or your guests have any thoughts on this?
Well, unless somebody wants to jump, I'll tell you from my perspective. I don't want to say you're out of purview, but the problem is that this is not the area of expertise of either of my guests. So I think that when we start talking electoral law, which I think we should be able to factor in, maybe a little closer to the election, but not that much closer. I think that that point, that's a more viable question. I think for tonight, it's a little out of the purview of what we were talking about.
Fair enough.
All righty. You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7. I'm Jeff Hayden. Tonight, we're talking about insurrection and the law with renowned author and and with legal and political, and if you have questions to my guest, our phone number is 415-841-4134. Again, 415-841-4134. If you're outside of San Francisco, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. As always, you can call regarding any question on tonight's topic, or as you see, sometimes a little off tonight's topic. You're not limited to the exact point we may be in our conversation, which when we left off, Dean, you were talking about the president invoking these two legal bases to send troops, or in his case, federal agents into the cities. And I invite you to pick up where you left off.
Yeah, you know, one of the problems is we don't even know what to call these guys. Are these troops, are these agents? Is this the militia? They don't have a name. They don't carry any insignia except police. But I think the real question is, why these troops and why now? Is this part of a strategy that the president has put together? Is he gaming out the situation, the political situation, from now until November and into January? And I think the answer has to be yes. If you look at his campaign ads and if you look at what he's doing in the cities, they're all of a piece. I mean, we have these ads where you see the face of Joe Biden imposed over a riot scene. And the tagline is, America, you're not going to be safe in Joe Biden's world if he's elected. And at the same time, the president himself is sending in these people who are, if anything, exacerbating the violence that we have on the streets and calling out the names of certain cities, including Bay Area cities, and saying, we're going there, and thereby causing federal buildings in those areas, in those cities, to become targets and causing demonstrations to become larger and more violent. And it seems to me that this is all part of a strategy leading up to what Trump anticipates is going to happen in November. And I think that's what Professor Douglas has done a profound analysis about and what we should talk about.
Not so much about the president and the Briar Patch, he's saying don't throw him in, but about what's coming. But first, let me turn it to Doug from San Francisco. Welcome to Your Legal Rights. Doug, are you still on the phone with us? Doug, we can't hear you. We're going to come back to you in a moment. Let me turn it to the professor, because I think, as Dean said, this is why your book is so timely. You want to tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah, so I guess my book really is asking the question, or the question that I kind of posed to myself when I was writing it was, you know, how well is our system of federal and constitutional law prepared to deal with a situation in which a sitting president either contests an electoral defeat or rejects electoral defeat. And I guess the somewhat sobering conclusion that I reached is that our system is really not particularly well designed to deal with that kind of problem at all. In fact, there are kind of gaps, omissions, and also probably poorly crafted aspects of our system such that if we were to find ourselves in an electoral crisis, the kind of laws that we have in place would arguably exacerbate the crisis, make it worse rather than solve it. And I really should emphasize that my concern is less about Trump refusing to leave the White House on January 20th, come noon. It's not really my book is not really kind of imagined as a sequel to 7 days in May or so. It's I don't really necessarily imagine him barricading himself in the Oval Office surrounded by a phalanx of rogue Secret Service agents and needing to be frog marched out by members of the military. It's really my real concern is the kind of constitutional democratic damage that Trump can inflict on this country between November 3rd, when we go to the polls, and January 20th, when he would have to leave office. That's really where I think the country could see a very troubling period.
Now, Professor, you play out a really dramatic scenario. And as I understand it, you're not so much concerned with the situation where Trump is trounced in the polls or Joe Biden is trounced in the polls. You're really concerned with a disputed election, where it's close and questionable, and you lay out that scenario in some detail. Could you tell our listeners how you see that playing out?
Yeah.
Well, before we get there, sorry to jump in on you, but we do need a station break. You're listening to Your Legal Rights. We'll be back right after this.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association Lawyer Referral Service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW. While we've been not able to broadcast, we've been able to broadcast, but without returning to the studio, we've not until now been able to resume our Call a Lawyer Night feature until now. Next week, for the first time in 5 months, we resume this valuable service on via Zoom.com with a feature to be known as Zoom a Lawyer. Given the current economic conditions, this first go around will be limited to landlord-tenant law. Details will be listed at the KALW website, KALW.org, under this program. But in short, you can check in from anywhere you have access to a computer. You'll be matched with a lawyer off of the air. You will not be on the radio broadcast. And this will be, again, to answer your landlord-tenant questions. That Zoom a Lawyer next week from 6 o'clock to 7 o'clock right here at KALW.org. And before we broke, you were just starting to talk plays out or how this gets started. Why don't I let you pick up where you left off?
So I think the question was how the election could really go sideways in November and what kind of mischief Trump could cause. And exactly as Dean was suggesting, I really think the danger is if the election turns on rather narrow margins in a handful of swing states, which we should remind ourselves is exactly what happened in 2016. That is, Hillary Clinton, of course, won the popular vote quite resoundingly by a margin of 3 million votes. But of course, in our system, the popular vote, the national popular vote outcome is not dispositive of who becomes the president. And as you recall, in 2016, Trump gained the White House because he carried Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania by a total of 70,000 votes. And arguably, those same states are going to be in play come this November. And what I really worry about is that Trump could enjoy a slim margin of, he could enjoy a slim lead on November 3rd. But that lead is based on the fact that there will be hundreds of thousands, if not millions of mail-in ballots in these states, which are yet to be counted. And we've already seen that he's engaged in these very aggressive preemptive strikes on mail-in ballots, insisting that mail-in ballots can't be trusted, that mail-in ballots are going to make the election corrupt. In this interview with Chris Wallace that probably many of the listeners saw or read about. He said that as a result of these mail-in ballots, we're likely to see the most corrupt election in American history. And you might ask yourself, well, why is he so concerned with mail-in ballots? Well, the fact of the matter is, given the pandemic that we're experiencing, the mail-in ballots are going to tend to be used by people in densely populated urban areas. And we know that people in densely populated urban areas vote overwhelmingly Democratic. And that then creates the possible scenario in which Trump has a narrow lead in the swing states on November 3rd because all these mail-in ballots haven't been counted. As the mail-in ballots are counted, we see that Biden is now carrying these swing states. But Trump presents Biden's post-election lead as confirming everything he said that he predicted. That is, the election is going to be contaminated. The election has been contaminated as a result of these mail-in ballots. And that, I think, creates a very dangerous scenario in which Trump insists that based on the November 3rd lead, he has been reelected and that he's successful, at least among his base and among his megaphones in the right-wing media, in convincing people that the results that are tallied late in the day as a result of the count of mail-in ballots, that they're not to be trusted.
Well, you know, I think this is a very chilling scenario. I noticed that you mentioned that key states for Trump are Michigan and Wisconsin. And guess what? Trump just announced some of the cities where he plans to send troops in order to, he says, quell violence. But I think we've experienced the fact that that's going to just exacerbate violence. And where is he sending the troops? Detroit and Milwaukee. Key urban areas in two of those swing states. But just to follow up on that, you know, as you point out, we have had disputed elections. The last several presidential elections have been extremely close. But when we get to a disputed election, a la 2000 Bush versus Gore, people are going to say, well, wouldn't it just go to the Supreme Court and wouldn't they just decide? I think you don't have a lot of confidence in that scenario, right?
Well, I mean, even if we think back to 2000, when, of course, the Supreme Court did intervene 35 days after the nation went to the polls, you know, many people think that, well, for better or worse, the Supreme Court brought closure to this election dispute. That is, even if the Supreme Court decision was openly partisan, even if it was poorly reasoned, we needed some type of closure. But I think it's very misleading to believe that it was the Supreme Court that brought closure to the 2000 election. I think, in fact, it was Al Gore who brought closure, who on the day after the Supreme Court rendered its decision, Gore very gracefully and graciously conceded. And what he basically did is he put the interests of the nation ahead of his own political fortunes. And I think everything that we know about Donald Trump tells us that it's impossible to imagine him doing the same thing. And indeed, if we imagine slotting Donald Trump into the position of Al Gore back in 2000, we would have already experienced a very horrific electoral meltdown back then. It really was only the gracious behavior of the key actors at the time that saved us from a meltdown 20 years ago. And I don't think that we can rely on similar good behavior this time around.
And there's certainly
at this point, and turn it to Suzanne in Oakland. Welcome to your legal rights.
Hello. So listening to all this and just thinking about everything up until this point, it's nice what you're talking about, which are the legalities. Now, how about let's put on the table what's been going on heavily in the last 15, 20 years of elections. With Republican vote suppression, which they've gotten caught in. So that's going to be on steroids all over the nation. Trump has already dog whistle called to his militia, and what kind of possible bloodiness is going to go on at polling places, especially in some of the more like Michigan and Pennsylvania and places that are kind of the hinge states. And we've got that going on. Trump's already setting the stage to bring in the police, the secret police, who we don't know who the hell they are. And so he's setting that stage already now so that he can say, oh, well, you know, it's all chaos and I have to bring them in, so we'll have martial law. I mean, there's so many ways that he's going at discounting the vote before it even gets there. But please don't not talk about what the Republicans have been doing over and over and over to suppress the vote, because it's been going on. So if we're not in a third world dictatorship country, we might as well be. And it's appalling. I don't even know an English word to describe how horrible this is.
So, yeah, Suzanne, you know, I totally agree with you.
Oh, yeah, wait. And then I forgot COVID. That's on the back burner, which is absolutely insanity. But I won't go down that one because that's a whole nother show. So
that's a whole nother show. And to Dan, I think you have some sympathetic votes here. with what you've been sharing with us. But I think, as I told Star Child before, this would probably be a better discussion in our upcoming elections, which I see probably coming in early September. It's a little off topic tonight. Tonight, we're looking more at outside of the election itself. What happens if troops or agents are used now to stir things up and make the election untenable? Or alternatively, what happens if we have an election in which the president loses and decides not to leave? These are really the related issues for tonight. I appreciate you chiming in. I'll give my guest a chance to, if they want to answer any further, but I'll thank you for calling and ask that you take your answer on the air.
Thanks, Suzanne. Actually, I totally agree with Suzanne. I see all of this voter suppression, the recruitment of a national police force, the use of media to do campaign ads that appeal to racism and hatred and division, all as a piece. And I think it's an attempt by Donald Trump to ensure his victory in the election, which at this point looks fairly questionable, but to also ensure that a scenario, if he doesn't clearly win, that a scenario such as what Professor Douglas has laid out actually occurs. Now, if I could kind of follow up with Professor Douglas, we're talking about the Supreme Court. I think you also talk about a scenario in which there would be a jurisdictional battle between the branches of government that actually Congress might ultimately step in and have the final word, or try to have the final word on who wins this election and who doesn't, yes?
Yeah, so this is how things can get very ugly. So I think the last point I had made was observing how Trump could try to insist that he carried these swing states based on a lead on November 3rd, even if that lead evaporates once the huge volume of mail-in ballots are counted. Further complicating that issue is we have to bear in mind that that our key swing states of Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin, they all share the same political profile in that they're all controlled by Republican legislatures. And the reason I think that is critical is depending on how delayed the vote counts in these swing states occur. That is, if there are problems and delays with the counting of these mail-in ballots, we could imagine that the Republican-controlled legislatures in these states actually support Trump's contention that he carried the state based on the November 3rd result. And if they do that, they could recognize him as the winner, and they could certify his slate of electors and send that onto Congress. At the same time, kind of contributing to the potential electoral meltdown is the fact that in those same states, we have Democratic governors. And we can imagine those Democratic governors responding by saying, no, we're not going to award our states to Trump. We have to recognize the full vote. Even it takes days and weeks after Election Day to kind of finish our state canvas. And based on the final vote, we recognize that Biden has carried these states. And so they recognize Biden as the winner. They send his electoral certificates on to Congress. Come January 6, 2021, that's the date on which Congress is, according to the Constitution, empowered with opening up these electoral certificates and determining who the winner is. And typically, this is a pro forma exercise. But not necessarily in 2021, because we could imagine that if Congress is confronted with these competing electoral certificates, and if Congress remains divided as it is presently, then we basically are really in a stalemate position. We're in a position which really could be a particularly dangerous position, because we could also imagine that all the while between November 3rd and January 6th, Trump is out there tweeting, insisting that he has been reelected, and again that his arguments find support and amplification in his reliable megaphones in the right wing media.
And the Congress that would be examining this question would be the Congress that we have right now.
Actually, it would not. So.
Okay.
So it's interesting. So adding a kind of another complication to the whole thing is that the Congress that would be responsible for sorting through these conflicting electoral certificates is not the present Congress. It would be the Congress which itself is elected this fall, and which would be sworn in 3 days before the opening of these electoral certificates. It would be sworn in on January 3rd, 2020. And the reason that's important to bear in mind is whatever kind of delays in the counting of mail-in ballots could plague the presidential election, they could also plague all these down-ballot elections as well. So it's very possible that the composition of the Senate would still be up in grabs. And that, again, kind of just adds another layer of complication. And the idea that the Supreme Court at this point, once the electoral dispute reaches Congress, the idea that the Supreme Court could intervene in order to save us, that I think we have to kind of abandon that idea, because I think most people would say once an electoral dispute reaches Congress, the Supreme Court has no role to play whatsoever in its resolution.
There's just no basis for Supreme Court jurisdiction.
Correct.
You've laid out a worst case scenario. Have we ever been here before? I mean, this sounds like something that might not even be resolved by Inauguration Day. If yes. We've been here before, is there any real likelihood that this could occur?
Yeah, I mean, lest your listeners conclude this is just a kind of a Twilight Zone fantasy spun out by a professor with too much time on his hand as a result of a COVID pandemic, I should remind your listeners that this is exactly what happened in 1876. This is the famous or notorious Hayes-Tilden election. In the Hayes-Tilden election, you likewise had three different states submit competing electoral certificates to Congress. Congress was likewise divided with a Republican-controlled Senate and a Democratic-controlled House. And as a result of that, Congress found itself in an absolute stalemate. And this electoral crisis in 1876, it almost tore the nation apart. The crisis wasn't resolved until 2 days before inauguration. In fact, the incumbent president at the time, Ulysses S. Grant, was terrified that both Tilden and Hayes were going to organize separate and competing inaugural balls. And he considered declaring martial law as a result. And as some of your listeners might recall from, you know, American history, there was a compromise that was hammered out 2 days before the Inauguration Day. But I should emphasize that that compromise, it might have saved us from an electoral catastrophe, but it also did not save the country from a true disaster, because the terms of that compromise stipulated that Rutherford B. Hayes, the Republican, would become president in return for a pledge on the part of congressional Republicans to remove federal troops from the South, basically ending Reconstruction. And that, of course, paved the way toward to the system of Jim Crow and to a system of basically of racial apartheid in the South. So I think we could say that catastrophe was averted through disaster.
And the guy who's sitting in the White House now is not a compromising kind of guy.
Exactly.
Not the sort of guy who may back out and try to work for the good of the Republic.
No, I mean, he seems to be concerned about his brand and his brand only. And we've seen that he is willing to engage in constitutional brinkmanship.
So it's at least theoretically possible that we could get to January 20th and we'd have on one stage John Roberts swearing in Joe Biden, on another stage Clarence Thomas swearing in Donald Trump, and on yet another stage Ruth Bader Ginsburg swearing in Nancy Pelosi.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure if we would necessarily get the three different ones, but certainly two. I mean, I could certainly imagine if there was that kind of stalemate and the stalemate was unable to be resolved by the Congress, that, you know, by the terms of the Presidential Succession Act of 1947, Nancy Pelosi would be sworn in as the acting president. But that, again, also presupposes, precisely as you've been saying, Dean, that the actors are behaving in good faith. And that is not something we can assume in the case of Trump. And not only do we have to factor in the idea that Trump is going to be insisting that, in fact, he was reelected, and it's just the radical Dems and the members of the fake news that are trying to steal his electoral victory, we have to factor in the reality that we're probably going to see the Russians and other foreign adversaries using social media as a way of further destabilizing any confidence that we have in whatever results the country is trying to frame. And so it really becomes a recipe for a very unhappy time.
Yeah, so if we get to this nightmare scenario, is there any legal provision for a redo of the election or a special election or anything like that?
Yeah, again, if we had a parliamentary system or something along those lines, you could imagine. I mean, we know that parliamentary systems, you can have these special elections called, you can have votes of no confidence that result in new elections. We don't have anything like that. We really don't even have, we have no mechanism for having a fresh election. And in fact, the joint session of Congress that would convene on January 6, 2021, in a sense, that joint session would continue after Nancy Pelosi had been sworn in as acting president. And that joint session, we should bear in mind, would now no longer have a president, because the president presiding over the Senate would be the vice president, Pence. He would no longer be the vice president. And so, yeah, we have no mechanism for walking ourselves back from this precipice.
We are just about out of time. And before we start to close out and give you each a chance to close out, the key question that I think is on people's tongues right now, is there anything we can do to avert this crisis? If we're really heading towards this crisis, what can we do about it?
Well, I would probably mention a couple of things. One thing I would mention, this goes back to the point that Dean was making earlier about Trump's deployment of these federal agents and the possible invocation of the Insurrection Act, is I think it's absolutely crucial for whatever activists and politically conscious people in this country not to let themselves get provoked, protests to remain peaceful. Because I really do believe that, as Dean suggested, Trump's desire is not to quell violence, it's to provoke and to trigger violence. And that way he can kind of cast himself as the great law and order president. The other thing I think is crucial is, I really think we can avoid, if I may just conclude with one further thought, I think we can avoid electoral meltdown if Trump loses decisively. And by decisively, again, I mean not just in the popular vote, because that's not dispositive. He has to lose decisively in the electoral college, and he has to lose decisively in the swing votes, in the swing states. And if he does lose decisively, I think his opportunities to engage in this kind of constitutional brinkmanship will be limited.
Well, with that, I think that will be the last word, in that we're essentially out of time. Would you like to take a couple minutes, each of you, for any closing thoughts?
Go ahead, Professor.
So again, maybe one thing I would say is that I'm not trying to be an alarmist. I think our best hope for averting an electoral catastrophe is to prepare ourselves for it and to kind of know the kind of dangers that we would face. The other things I might ask that I might add to that might help us avoid the kind of problems that we might encounter in the fall is, if you are voting by mail, I encourage you to do that early, because there'll be all sorts of litigation challenging the tardy submission of mail-in ballots. We know that the Postal Service is going to be overwhelmed with ballots coming in at the last moment. So if you want to guarantee that your vote counts and it counts in a meaningful fashion, make sure that you vote early.
Dean Johnson, want to take about 2 minutes for any closing thoughts?
Sure. I'd like to share with our listeners a quote that's been going through my head all week as I prepared for this show. There was a minister by the name of Martin Neumüller, who was arrested by the Gestapo in the early days of Hitler's regime. And he said this. He said, "First they came for the socialists. I did not speak out because I was not a socialist. Then they came for the trade unionists. I did not speak out because I was not a trade unionist. Then they came for the Jews. And I did not speak out because I was not a Jew. Then they came for me. And there was no one left to speak out. If this last few weeks has taught us anything, it's that democracy is a use it or lose it proposition. Yet most of us don't even vote. This is a critical time for our republic. You've got to get out and vote, but it takes more than that. It takes getting out, making your voice be heard. As the professor said, keep those protests peaceful, but get involved somewhere. And I'd invite all of our listeners to make a commitment tonight to, in some way, some small way, get involved, because our democracy is right on the edge right now.
With that, Professor, Dean, I'd like to thank both of you for joining us tonight.
Pleasure, Jeff, as always.
Thanks so much for having me.
And I would love a chance to finish up. A lot of questions that remain. We'll talk about maybe part two at an upcoming date. You've been listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. Tonight, we've been discussing insurrection in the law. Our guests have been Professor Lawrence Douglas of Amherst College, author of Will He Go? Trump and the Looming Election Meltdown of 2020. And Emmy-nominated and political, legal and political commentator Dean Johnson. And again, thank you both for joining us.
Thanks, Jeff.
And thank all of you for joining us. We'll be back next week at our new time of 6 o'clock once again, where we'll discuss unfair business practices. Also next week, as we've been unable to resume our Call a Lawyer Night feature, we will find information on how to reach us via Zoom on the KALW website. Given the current economic conditions, this first go-around will be limited to landlord-tenant law. Details will be on the program website at klw.org. But in short, you can check in from anywhere where you have access to a computer and have a meeting one-on-one with a lawyer off of the air. You won't be on the radio to answer your landlord-tenant questions. That's Zoom a Lawyer next week from 6 o'clock to 7 o'clock right here at klw.org. So next week, our show will be looking at unfair business practices, unfair competition. In 2 weeks, we'll be back looking at elder financial abuse. Again, that's right here on Your Legal Rights. For Dean Johnson and Professor Lawrence Douglas, and at the controls, Debbie Kennedy, I'm Jeff Hayden. Our thanks to all of you for listening. Good night and stay safe.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information. Uh-huh.